Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Which phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's world service.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
There aren't too many football careers that resonate quite like that of Gianluca Vialli's, a superstar player at the height of Serie A's popularity. He won every trophy possible in Italian football, including the Scudetto with Sampdoria, a Champions League winner with Juventus before moving to Chelsea and playing, I think, quite a significant role in the rise of the Premier League to where it is today. And he carried all of this off with just a huge amount of charisma and charm. Vialli has died aged 58, and we paid tribute to him on the World Service today. Hey, Murph.
Hey, Owen, how's it going?
Terry Daly is sports correspondent with AFP in Milan. Here he is on Vialli's time at Sampdoria, his deep bond with Roberto Mancini, and those scenes at the end of the Euro 2020 final when the two men celebrated Italy's triumph together.
The club of his life really was Sampdoria. 8 seasons with Sampdoria, playing alongside Roberto Mancini. They ended up winning the league in 1991 in his second last season. He stayed on and they got to the European Cup final, the last ever so-called European Cup final, which they lost in extra time at Wembley to Johan Cruyff's Barcelona.
Yeah, the dream team, yeah.
The dream team, Barcelona, that was the story that ended up winning. But the story of Sampdoria winning that European Cup would have been actually a better story, really, when you look back at it, because Sampdoria is like a small club. And really, with this pair of players, Mancini and Vialli, managed to become one of the best teams in Europe. And is still, I think, in the 1991 title victory that they had, is regarded as one of the great Italian seasons. I mean, what can you say about the place of that team in kind of the affections of Italian football?
Well, I think, you know, I think Vialli and Mancini are two very popular figures here, partly because of you can see that they were, you know, you don't need to see it, they're true friends, you know, they were like brothers, really. And that kind of dynamic, not just when they were playing but also afterwards, has been a kind of, I don't know, just been a key thing, one of the big things about Italian football that you could kind of point to, is these two of the best players of their generation who kind of really quite openly
loved each other.
Yeah, they really loved each other. You know, it was really, really, it was really obvious. And also, I just think that, you know, any team that's not one of the big three winning the league, the strisciate, as they call them, the big striped teams in the north. Any team that can get past those and win the championship is always going to be held with some level of esteem. That championship, I mean, for Sampdoria fans, any Sampdoria fan who would have been there at the time, they'll know that that will never happen again. It's literally a once in a lifetime thing. So, but at the same time, it does. I mean, maybe it doesn't give teams now hope that they can win the league. Although, if you look at Napoli, then maybe it does, that the provincial teams can kind of do something against these against these three giants. I mean, then there was also the Verona title as well in the mid 1980s, which was another one, which came out out of nowhere. I think it was 1984, if I remember rightly. Yeah. But these smaller teams winning those league titles or becoming a force. I suppose you could even look at, say, Atalanta over the last 5, 6, 7 years, and say, okay, you know, it gives hope to those kind of teams that if they do things right, they can pack a punch and do something, because the hierarchies here are very, they're kind of very set in stone. I mean, I remember during the Calciopoli scandal and after when Juventus got relegated and Milan were given points deduction and stuff, and then Inter won, became the top team and won a series of titles. There was always this idea that, well, Juventus weren't really there; they'd been hammered by Calciopoli, as though that was, you know, someone else's fault. So their titles were kind of not really valid because they didn't have they didn't have Milan and Juventus at the top of their game, so you can't really judge the titles as seriously valid. Which kind of gives you an idea of what, you know, if you were in the UK or in England, Leicester's title isn't considered, you know, less valid because maybe Man City weren't quite at their best, or Chelsea weren't quite at their best, or Liverpool weren't quite at their best. It's not really looked like that. So, you know, the kind of provincial teams that are under that and really struggle to win trophies because of it. I mean, any kind of fan who isn't a fan of one of those big three clubs is always going to look to something like that Sampdoria done, and with not just respect but also kind of hope, I think.
Looking back at the Euro 2020 win last year for Italy, I mean, even at the time it felt so poignant. You talked about the friendship between Mancini and Vialli, and Vialli was there in his role with the Italian FA. He was on the sideline. He was in all a lot of the social media videos that you'd see, and it's just such an amazing presence. Obviously, he had for a number of years already been battling his pancreatic cancer at that stage, but was well enough to be at the tournament and to be part of that success, which is, I mean, small consolation today, but it was a lovely sort of, I guess, epitaph to his career in Italian football to have such a role in that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, also, I think it was actually really nice for him, partly because his international career as a player was not really all that. You know, for him to have a role, even if it was, I mean, I wouldn't call it ceremonial as such, but it wasn't, you know, he wasn't a coach, he wasn't, you know.
He was the chief of delegation.
Delegation chief, yeah. But I mean, if I remember rightly, his last match for Italy, he played his last match for Italy in 1992.
I remember the 1990 World Cup, and mainly it was poor old Vialli, who was the starting striker in the tournament for Italy, ending up sitting disconsolate on the bench while this Scalacci, his substitute just completely stole the show and sidelined him basically as the tournament went on.
Yeah, I mean, he scored 16 goals for Italy, and I think he played something, I think it's 59 matches he played. So, I mean, it was a bit weird because he was such a good player domestically and so important for all of the teams that he played for. That his international career is disappointing. I mean, he didn't make the mark for Italy that a lot of his contemporaries did. As in fact, the same thing can be said for Mancini. I mean, Mancini's Italy career was never really got off and running at all. I mean, partly that's just due to the fact.
Is that just because they were Sampdoria and so they don't get taken seriously?
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily that. I think in Mancini's case, it was kind of he had a few.
Rows?
He had rows with coaches, and he didn't really like being told what to do. He was a bit more of a spiky kind of independent personality than the Italian football hierarchies tend to like. So I mean, he possibly could have played more, but I think he was kind of considered maybe a disruptive presence. Vialli's situation is just, I don't know, he just didn't perform for whatever reason. Maybe the teams didn't kind of play to his strengths or what have you. I mean, that can happen. So being on the pitch at Wembley again, it's in London, it's kind of the place where he's made his home. It's in a country where whose football he's always had a tremendous amount of respect for. It's against a national team that he has a tremendous amount of respect for, you know, and he's on the pitch at Wembley, you know, hugging his best friend and crying his eyes out. I think it was very, very cathartic for him to have and be present at that kind of success for the national team, which he which he didn't have as a player, and was sat on the bench when he watched Italy get eliminated by Maradona's Napoli in Naples in 1990. That was definitely a really, really, really big thing for him. I think it was a huge moment in his life. And if it's the last significant thing that he did before he died, I think he would, I think that's a pretty good, as far as it goes, a fairly good way to end it,
Very nicely put by Terry Daly there. We also heard the voice of Viali himself on the podcast today in conversation with myself and Ken back in 2007. He had a book out around that time called The Italian Job. Now, we played that interview for our members today to get a sense of the charisma and likability that Viali always seemed to exude, as, for example, when dealing with this question from Young Owen.
Gianluca, one last question for you. You're a famously bald man. Now, it wasn't always that way. I remember you in your early days, you had a great shock of hair. So it happens to the best of us. Ken here actually has got a long blonde locks, but he often talks about how worried he is about what he'll do when the hair eventually starts to fall out. What advice would you give him? Toupee or no?
Just shave it off. No, I shaved my hair. It was my choice when I did it. Now it has become a necessity because I've got very few hair left, so I've got to shave it, otherwise I don't think I would look particularly attractive. But I think it's nice. I'm quite happy that I was one of the first to do it, because there are so many bald men out there which have now solved their problems, because they can shave it and they can just walk around with no problems, without feeling they've got no complex whatsoever, and they're quite happy and proud to be bald, which is a good thing.
So you wouldn't advise people to go down the route that Bobby Charlton, I should say, used to go down with the kind of comb over?
No. Don't do the Bobby Charlton, do the Viali.
Don't do the Bobby Charlton, do the Viali, Murph. What a line.
It's a very
good line.
What a line
of questioning from me as well, it must be said.
I mean, talk about hiding the true nature of your question by using poor Ken as your example.
No, I didn't know. Murph, I was 27. I was 26, I think, even, maybe, when that was out. It wasn't on the horizon for me.
It happened very quickly for me after that point,
yeah.
I can only speak for my grey hairs, but I knew by the time I was 26, I knew exactly what lay in store, and not that far down the line either. I mean, you can make whatever excuse you like, but we know the true nature of McDevitt.
The full interview is available to listen to now from all those years ago, featuring other gems such as, is Rude Hullet a bit of an asshole? That was another question that Young Owen may or may not have posed to the great Gianluca Viali. But listen, at least Viali came across brilliantly in the interview, as he always did, Gianluca Viali. I'm not sure how much attention Frank Lampard paid to 14-year-old Evan Ferguson in the summer of 2019 when he came off the bench for Bowes against Chelsea during Lampard's first game in charge of the club, but the hulking figure of 18-year-old Evan Ferguson was surely stalking the nightmares of Lampard this week, scoring one goal, creating another in what could turn out to be one of Lampard's final games as the Everton manager. We spoke to Trevor Crawley this week, who coached young Evan Ferguson, who was very young at the time, at Bowes, and I asked him, well, he basically talked a lot about how great he was at pretty much all facets of the game, amazing attitude. So I did ask him specifically, were there any areas of the game that they were trying to get him to improve a bit?
Well, his finishing, he would have worked on that constantly, but it was quite good. He had a snap to his finishing, once it went in the box, he was very brave, got across people in the box, and you can get hurt there at early areas, but yeah, he had that kind of finishing that we would have worked on that, obviously, with him as a striker, and his build up play. But yeah, he was Evan turned up bright eyed, bushy tailed, ready to. He was really easy to coach, and nearly in some ways, my experience of him, you would nearly forget Evan was there somewhat, because he turned up, loved football. You got the impression he was there to learn, and was really easy to coach. There was no baggage, no difficulty with Evan. Appeared to me to love football, came up, barely drop him up, leave him there, work hard, work really, really hard, have quality, go home and repeat. And yeah, it's kind of a lovely, lovely way to be.
Murph, nobody in the Premier League can stop this young Irish goal machine. Perhaps Middlesbrough can do it in the FA Cup tomorrow. Will Roberto De Zerbi even play Ferguson in the Cup, or would he save his star man for the Premier League test to come?
Immediately, he's gotten to that level now where it's an insult to play him in the FA Cup. You know, what have I done to deserve this?
Should Ferguson turn down a starting role if he's given it?
Honestly, Owen, I mean, if you're asking, if I was advising Evan Ferguson right now, I would be inclined to say it. Throw the toys out of the pram. No good can possibly come from you playing against lowly Middlesbrough. I mean,
you score a goal, people say it's only the cup. You know? Yeah. You don't score a goal, it's like, it's Ferguson all that. I think he's a purity of Premier League player from now on for Brighton. I think that's fair to say.
I mean, that's his level on. And, you know, the sooner De Zerbi recognises this, quite frankly, the better.
Tired of ads interfering with your favourite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Trippier on the right-hand side. Trippier with a cross towards the back post. Shaw scores on the volley! England lead in the second minute of the final!
And it's laces from Shaw. In off the near post. No chance for Donnarumma. What a start from England.
A rientrare, pallone in mezzo ancora. Lo gira Cristante, poi la palla in porta, palo! Rete! Cogna! E Leonardo Bonucci, il grinta!
Have done very well to get this far, and it is penalties. Here comes Belotti, and Pickford saves down to his left.
Now Rashford, quasi adagio, ferma palo fuori.
Jadon Sancho comes up, a little delay, and it's saved by Donnarumma.
La prende Donnarumma!
So Jorginho now sets up, and there's the little delay, and Pickford saved it! Oh my goodness, down to his right!
La presa!
Oh!
Incredibile! La presa Pickford.
Have you ever?
La presa Pickford. La presa Pickford. Incredibile. La presa Pickford.
So Bukayo Saka now, the 19-year-old. Saka is already waiting. It's not a long run-up. Here he comes. Oh, he
siamo!
Donnarumma
siamo! Campioni d'Europa! 23-54 minuti in Italia! L'Italia è campione d'Europa per la seconda volta nella sua storia!
There's a lot going on in the Premier League this week, and we do cover plenty of it on the show, as you heard there with the Evan Ferguson bit. But Ken still found time, and lots of it, to discuss a man no longer playing in England, Cristiano Ronaldo, who has joined Al Nassr in Saudi Arabia.
Ronaldo is, I guess, the second most popular athlete in Saudi Arabia.
Behind Leo Messi?
Yeah, I mean, even the coach at Al Nassr said jokingly, "Oh, well, actually, I wanted to sign Messi." And you're like, "You shouldn't have said that."
Oh, no.
You shouldn't. You shouldn't have said that. He doesn't do jokes. He especially doesn't do that joke. You know, Rudy Garcia, it is who's over there, who came out with that one. But I think it's the problem for Ronaldo here. I mean, on the one level, you're like, "Oh, you know, is it so bad? He's making all this." And you know, he's nearly 38. Like, I mean, what else is he supposed to do? I think the problem is kind of pissing on his own legacy. I think it's a major mistake that he's made. I mean, because it's not like, it's not as though he's finished up at Manchester United and, you know, this is the best offer that he has, and, you know, they've sold him the dream of making football popular in Saudi Arabia. See, the thing is, it already is really popular in Saudi Arabia. You know, that was clear. That was one of the very evident things about the World Cup, the number of Saudi fans who were there, and the kind of the culture of the Saudi fans was not maybe what you would expect. You know, if you think of Saudi Arabia as like a conservative country, you know, you might say for instance, when you saw the Qatari fans of the World Cup, all the Qataris are wearing the, you know, white tobe and so on at the games. The Saudis were mostly wearing sweaty green polyester football shirts and screaming at the tops of their lungs. You know what I mean? There was more of a kind of a recognizably football type culture there among, I mean, there was plenty of rich dudes in tobes as well, of course. But definitely, though, this does do is it really damages his legacy by the way that he's kicked his way out of Manchester United, which is a major club. I mean, one of the biggest clubs in the world. And all of those, not all, but I mean, a lot of Manchester United fans who previously would have idolized Ronaldo, notwithstanding what's happened, you know, his kind of less good performances over the last year or so, we'll just think of him as he's kind of massively diminished in their eyes by this.
Yeah,
I feel like, and it's like another, I think, a blow. I mean, if Ronaldo is concerned about his legacy, I mean, he has no chance really of being considered among the greatest players.
What? You know, Ronaldo doesn't have a chance of being considered among the greatest players?
No.
What are you talking? No. Of course he's among the greatest players.
No, he's a goal scorer. He's a goal scorer.
Was Pelé not a goal scorer?
He wasn't just a goal scorer, Owen. He wasn't just a goal scorer. I think what Ronaldo has done here is like his, it's like, it's quite dramatic in the sense that it's like his fatal flaw as a footballer, and also as a professional in terms of managing his career, is the inability to conceive of himself as being part of a team. He always has seen himself as kind of a lone wolf. You know what I mean? Like he's like, I'm a superhero. These sort of carbon blobs or whatever are also here to fill out the team, but it's all about me. And, you know, I think that kind of shone through in his attitude. I mean, what, you know, why is he so desperate to get out of there? You know what I mean? Like,
there's no denying he's a rampant egotist. I'm not denying that for a second, but I would have an issue with the idea that because things have ended so messily at Manchester United, suddenly his entire career is looked at differently.
No,
I mean, he built up a career that stacks up with almost anyone who's ever played the game.
I don't think it's, well, he, as he says himself, the numbers don't lie, but it's not about numbers. I mean, he would like for it to be about numbers, but it's not. You know, the thing about, okay, so I'm not saying that it's because of how he leaves Manchester United that, you know, I think that this doesn't help, because there was a whole lot of people who, for whom he was like a hero, who, to whom he's now an annoying figure. You know what I mean? Like, who kind of see him differently now. But really it has to do with his kind of conception of the game. His conception of the game as being about numbers, as being about goals, the way that he evolved as a player towards just being ever more specialized as a goal scorer, which really ultimately is about like being the kind of glory player in the team, rather than what actually the greatest players. I mean, you know, Ronaldo's a great player, like by the standards of, he's definitely one of the top handful of footballers. But if you're talking about the legendary era-defining players, I don't think he's ultimately going to be remembered that way.
It's funny you're talking about it like that, because we reposted your chat with Tim Vickery from about Pelé from last year when the Netflix documentary came out, and Vickery feels that Pelé always did himself a disservice by, similar to Ronaldo, focusing on the numbers so much. You know, he was always fiercely proud of protecting his goal scoring legacy and you know, comparing his numbers to anybody else, because he knew nobody else would ever get the amount of goals that would match up to that. And Tim felt actually that the Pelé career was about more than just those goals, even though the man himself nearly boiled it down to that in sort of one way of looking at it.
Well, the goals, I mean, everyone understands the numbers, you know, the lingua franca of 1,000 goals or whatever. But it's not what Pelé is really celebrated for, I don't think, is it 1,000 goals. I mean, did Romario score 1,000 goals? Like, nobody cares. You know, he certainly claimed to, right? Romario claimed to make it there. But nobody really cares because at the end of the day, he was like a guy who scored lots of goals. He was brilliant at it. But like, he didn't sort of define the era. He didn't ruin the game. Ronaldo
did, though. Ronaldo, along with Messi, defined this era.
It's Messi's era. And Ronaldo is like a guy who scored a lot of goals for the main team that Messi was playing against, you know, Real Madrid. Mm. But like even at Real Madrid, will they remember it as the Ronaldo era? Or will it be, when they look back, will they go, you know, actually, the real hero was Luka Modric all along? You know, I think when you consider the insane, I mean, he scored 450 goals in, was it 438 matches for Real Madrid? It's ridiculous. It's an insane record. And yet people will look back and go, yeah, was he the best player in the team? I think lots of people will actually do that because he almost sort of retreated from the responsibility of what a really great player does. And I'm talking about Pelé, Cruyff, Maradona, and Messi, these are players who do everything. And Ronaldo kind of retreated towards the, well, how can I make, you know, how can I get the largest number of goals? And that, and I can win that way. And it was a mistake. You know, whether he could have done what Messi does or whether he could have done what these other players say, I'm not sure. Maybe he recognized his limitations. But, you know, I think he's not in that level. I mean, I was looking recently at the, obviously Pelé died, and I think I mentioned it to you on during the World Cup. I mean, Pelé had been ill. I'd seen that Hugh McIlvany speech. Hugh McIlvany did the speech, the now late Hugh McIlvany, in 2018, which was some Football Writers Association dinner over in London where they'd organised to honour Pelé, who actually couldn't turn up because I think he was ill as well at that time. But McIlvany gave a speech anyway. And the speech was like a, you know, you could, it, at times, sounds a bit like a classic reactionary, these kids have no idea what happened at, you know, the Aztec Stadium in 1970. You know what I mean? It's, yeah. And he's obviously really annoyed at this kind of insistence that like Maradona, or rather Messi and Ronaldo, this is 2018, are like better than anything we've seen before. And one of the things he says, some people who should know better are ready to tell us that Messi has proved himself a footballer. He's already described Messi and Ronaldo as, what was the words? Entertaining and productive, right? Both of which are kind of faint praise. Like entertaining is like, a soap opera is entertaining. You know what I mean? Like,
well, productive is definitely.
Productive, definitely, you know what I mean? Like,
you're not exactly waxing lyrical. Hugh McIlvany had a lot of words in his locker, and he could have produced some other ones if he wanted to.
He could have gone a bit higher than productive in terms of the praise. But he says, some people who just should know better are ready to tell us that Messi has proved himself a footballer. He didn't spit the word Messi. He has proved himself a footballer substantially superior to Diego Maradona. Now, Messi is one of the ultimate joys of the contemporary football lover's life. A genius whose artistry simultaneously stirs the blood and makes us smile with a mixture of awe and sheer pleasure. But Messi, like Ronaldo, is a magnificent forward and phenomenal goal scorer. On the field, Maradona was a maker of worlds, certainly a shaper of World Cups. So, okay, the point he's making there is, yeah, you haven't actually done it in the main competition. And unfortunately, Hugh McIlvany didn't live to see the World Cup that we've just seen, which I think by his own kind of logic, he would have had to say, well, he's more than I was giving him credit for. You know what I mean? Which I think, to be fair, was already obvious in 2018 when he kind of put Messi into the same category as Ronaldo as like a, what's the phrase, magnificent forward and phenomenal goal scorer. But actually he was doing a whole lot more. And I think Messi always understood, you know, as Pelé did, that this is a team game. You know, that's ultimately what it's about. You're actually part of a team. You may be by far the best player in it, but like you're still, you're still part of it and you should work with that. I mean, when you look at Pelé, what is it that the... I mean, we didn't see Pelé play football. And what we see of him is just the tiny fraction that's sort of left or that's recorded of, you know, this huge career that he had. But even just watching the 1970 footage, what's amazing about it is actually not even... it's not the goals, it's the goals he doesn't score. You know what I mean? Like the running around the goalkeeper.
That's what I was saying last week, and I noticed this in the immediate aftermath of him dying. That was the biggest... that was the video that I saw shared most widely, probably, or certainly popping up in my feeds the most, was the one where he dummies the goalkeeper against Uruguay. There was obviously the Czechoslovakia, wasn't it? The shot from the halfway line. Supposedly to prove to his critics that his eyesight was still good. That was one of the probably myths that went around about Pelé around that time. But yeah, sorry, go on.
And the but the little passes, like the tiny little passes to Jairzinho against England. So the goal against England where he controls the ball and kind of pivots as he's sort of almost leaning. He sort of has to come back to control this ball. And then sort of pivots, almost leaning over it, and then just toes the little pass to Jairzinho, which takes out the whole defense, and that's the goal. Or obviously then the pass to Carlos Alberto, which is like, in one sense, it's the easiest pass you could ever play. It's just like, but like everything about it, like the control, the pause, you know, to size up the situation, and then to play, he has to play the pass in an almost lazy way to give Carlos Alberto time to just arrive at the perfect moment. Like it's these things which are so beautiful and are so memorable, far more so than, you know, hundreds and hundreds of goals which weren't recorded and which we don't, you know, apparently they happened, but we don't, you know what I mean? It's, that doesn't really... the question I think for Ronaldo is, having kind of lost, in my opinion, battle to be considered as the best player, can he... And I think this is obviously bad for his legacy for reasons which I don't need to repeat now because I just said them all. Can he actually do it? Can he maintain? Like, I think he would basically have to be that guy, I show speed, to seriously insist that like Ronaldo was the best or was worthy of comparison with these types of players now, right? In other words, somebody who doesn't really understand what they're talking about. Can he do it?
Somebody though? Like me, then, is what you're saying. But go on.
Well, you don't. I know that you don't really believe it. I know that I don't
believe that Ronaldo is one of the best players in the history of football. I do believe he has been. Yeah,
he's one of the best goal scorers. I would describe him as a magnificent, but all those things, phenomenal goal scorer.
You're talking as though all he ever did was score goals in losing teams or something. Like, I mean, he did win a ton of Champions League. He won loads of trophies with the teams that he played in, and he was a vital part of that. And you can talk now about Luka Modric, but I don't think people were saying that at the time when they were both in the same team. Ronaldo was the man, and he did it in the biggest clubs, at a couple of the biggest clubs, probably three of the biggest clubs in the world, until Juventus maybe went off the rails.
He did, and I think that's why he will always have a place in that second tier of footballers who score a lot of goals. The question is whether he can, what his sort of legacy is going to be, and to what extent he can maybe continue to be considered as the best with pure propaganda. You know, he was celebrating the other day, reaching 400 million Instagram followers. There's a lot of money behind this Saudi thing. Oh, not just the money that they're paying directly to him, but there's going to be a big push going on here, which obviously him arriving is part of. And then you've got guys like Rio Ferdinand. You know, I saw Gary Neville, for instance, had said there's a bit of sadness to this, you know, because I mean it's obviously like it's a massive anticlimax. You know, here's a guy who thought he was going to be, or I guess that the idea was, get out of Man United, this prison of mediocrity, right? Get out, kick my way out of there, go to the World Cup, smash in a load of goals, clubs will be queuing up for me. You know, I'm still... and instead it's like, actually, you lose your place in the Portugal team, you get outscored comfortably by Gonçalo Ramos, it doesn't really happen, and at the end of the day, nobody else comes in for you and you're off to Riyadh. So it is, it's not good. And Neville used the word sadness, which Rio Ferdinand was extremely annoyed by. What an adventure, what a prospect that is. This is Rio talking about the prospect of moving to Riyadh. What a prospect to go and play football in a brand new league. A competitive league, by the way. I played in a testimonial over there years ago. It was an unbelievable game. We were all surprised with the madness, the mayhem around football over there. The love of football in Saudi is crazy. I'm sure it's going to be a great adventure. It's a new chapter. The next chapter. The way the World Cup ended for him, a tinge of sadness in terms of being on the bench, not having a huge impact on his last one, that's a tinge of sadness. But this next chapter, going to Saudi Arabia, how do you look at that as a sadness? A sad way to end his career? I don't understand how people are saying that. So Rio, at least, is
sticking by his man.
Yeah, and I mean, Rio knows plenty about Saudi Arabia, because only a few weeks ago, he was over in Riyadh himself at the Catalyze Saudi conference as a guest of the Saudi Ministry of Investment.
Was he?
Where he discussed Saudi Arabia's, this is a quote from the press release, he was discussing Saudi Arabia's transformation and what the World Cup in Qatar meant for the wider region's sports and hospitality sectors, alongside David Grutman, the respected Floridian nightclub owner. So all I'm saying, Owen, is Rio obviously has seen the bright side of this Saudi thing. I mean, again, he has been, He's been to Riyadh certainly more times than I have, and I'm sure there's plenty of other people as well who over the coming years will also go to Riyadh or Jeddah or wherever, maybe as guests of the Saudi Ministry of Investment, maybe as guests of other people, and we'll also say, you know, actually this is pretty good, you know, this is you know, if Pele was here, he would be there. Actually, he might. There's a pretty good chance Pele would have done the same thing.
Murph, you weren't there for that little broadside by Ken on the reputation of the football,
I've
reputation of Cristiano Ronaldo.
I've plenty of correspondence since then, as I think editor at Second Captains has also. Yeah. Let's just say there's wide divergence of opinion.
I mean, you basically agreed with Ken. Do you know what it is? I feel you're clearly spurned as a Man United fan by the bridge-burning nature of his recent departure. You might even regret in years to come not standing up for him. When you look back at his United career as a whole, rather than just have this image of him spouting off to Piers Morgan in your head at the moment, which is all you think about when you think about Cristiano Ronaldo.
That is true. And I have to say that, you know, by the time 2008 came around, I respected the man as a footballer, but... Oh. You know, let's just say Cristiano Ronaldo, regardless of anything he did after he left Man United the first time, was, even while he was at Manchester United, in his first stint at the club,
beginning to great,
he would not have been in my top 50 favourite Man United players of all time. I mean, I respected the man's numbers, but yeah.
Clayton Blackmore level, Lee Martin,
Mark Hughes, Andrei Kanchelskis, you know, they can't even see Cristiano Ronaldo from their lofty position in my Manchester United favourite 50 footballers.
Sign up to the World Service on secondcaptains.com for £5 a month plus VAT. If you do that, you will hear all episodes ad-free. The Second Captains podcast is, of course, part of the Acast Creator Network.
Thanks, Network. On. Thank
That's
you.
It. Thank you. Bye now.
The phone is at me. That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's world service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
If you're concerned about mental health or looking to get into self-improvement, join me at the Piece by Piece podcast. There, I'm interviewing everyday people and experts alike about how to overcome difficulties around mental health. Speaking of which, I just released an interview with a mental health historian and another with two friends who are healthcare workers.
If these conversations interest you, check us out at Piece by Piece. That's Piece with an A, B-I, and then Piece with an I. Thank you so much.